Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we will begin this hour with another view of the possibly history-making negotiations taking place in Lausanne, Switzerland, as Iran and U.S. negotiators, along with representatives from five other nations, seem to be edging toward a delayed, preliminary, but potentially historic Iranian nuclear deal. It's already exceeded its deadline twice. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told reporters the most difficult math was not in finding the exact number of Western sanctions to lift or uranium centrifuges to eliminate. It's the number of diplomatic voices in the P5 plus one group of negotiating nations that's the problem.
I wouldn't be breaking any secrets to you that P5 plus one have national positions. It is in my interest that they work as a group, not as individual countries.
Former U.S. Ambassador Dennis Ross, a longtime Middle East peace negotiator, is not likely to take that assessment from Iran's foreign minister at face value, although he admits the talks are complicated. Ross served as President Obama's special assistant on Iran from 2009 to 2011 and as President Clinton's chief U.S. negotiator for Arab-Israeli issues from 1993 to 2001. Ambassador Ross, welcome to The Takeaway.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
It's great to have you in the studio here. How do you rate these talks? What do you think are the weaknesses here? What concerns you the most?
Well, I think the talks themselves are not going to be decisive. Even if you get a framework understanding today or tomorrow or at some point very soon, we've seen the difficulty of even reaching this, which is still at some level of generality. The idea of having a finely tuned agreement with great technical detail done by June 30th suggests to me that if this has been difficult, that will truly be an ordeal. So I think that's what we're facing right now. And then the question is, gets to the heart of what are the real issues that are out there. The Iranians want the sanctions lifted immediately. We want the sanctions to be lifted only over time as we
see performance. After we verify.
That's right, yeah. As they implement what are the requirements on their side. We're also concerned that they not continue to do research and development on a next generation, a new generation of centrifuges. Understand they have basically developed four generations. The ones they're using, the IR-1s, were first generation. The design came from Pakistan. They're up to IR-8s, although those are not installed and operating. And they want to be able to basically do research and development beyond that. And we are, I think, also going to find that the scope of verification is also going to be a very hard nut to crack, maybe not at this stage, but before you close the deal itself.
According to unclassified or leaked documents from the Johnson administration and later, the U.S. was largely responsible for Pakistan getting a bomb and that technology ending up then in the hands of Iran. Do we trust Pakistan with a nuclear bomb any more than we trust or distrust Iran with a nuclear capacity of any capability at all?
And part of the problem is that obviously Pakistan's been a nuclear weapon state for a long time now.
Yeah.
We suspended assistance to Pakistan for a long time because of what they did. I think there's a lot of concern at one level about Pakistan, but it's a reality. Pakistan and India are kind of locked in a regional rivalry. Iran, we look at differently. We have a history with Iran that is very different. The hostages, you know, are still – there's still a bear legacy here. We lost 243 soldiers to Hezbollah in Beirut. Armed, backed, trained, an extension of the Iranians. So there's a deep history here with Iran. And also, Iran, as a member of the NPT, violated its understandings. It was supposed to reveal all its nuclear-related activities and didn't do that. So there's a history here that obviously raises questions for us as it relates to Iran. And also, Iran affects all of its neighbors. I mean, the Saudis and others, I can tell you from conversations I had with the King of Saudi Arabia in 2009 when I was in the administration, when I was dealing with him and I was trying to explain what we're doing with Iran, he simply said to me, if they get it, we get it.
We'll get to that in a moment. Violators of NPT, Iranians and others would say that the Israelis are violators of NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There are other violators of the Non-Proliferation Treaty that the U.S. seems to tolerate. Iran is different.
Well, Israel's not a member of the NPT. So hard to violate something you're
right.
not a member
well,
of.
I mean, that's even worse, arguably.
Well, the Iranians signed up to it, though, and then they are supposed to reveal all their nuclear-related activities. They never revealed their enrichment activities. What was done at Natanz and at Fordo was revealed, not by them, by us and by others. So there's a history here of them, in a sense, undertaking obligations but not necessarily being bound by the obligations.
Let's look regionally. Perhaps the best argument against this deal with Iran is that it would start a nuclear arms race in the Middle East with the Saudis wanting to be a nuclear power alongside the Iranians. Do you think that is the case?
Well, as I said, I mean, I had this conversation with the King of Saudi Arabia in May of 2009, where I sort of laid out what we were doing, why we were doing it, and he was not interested in any of the explanations. He simply wanted to say, if they get it, we get it.
Turki Al-Faisal, the former intelligence chief, has said this to the BBC within the last 3 weeks.
That's right. And I would even say it's something very interesting that people didn't really pick up. The Saudis had their National Day, and on the National Day they paraded Chinese-made missiles. And they had the chief of staff of the Pakistani military there to review in their reviewing parade. And it's clear that wasn't a signal for us. That was a signal to the Iranians that we have a capability. The missiles could carry a nuclear bomb, and it's clear that this was a signal to them. We're seeing a Saudi-Iranian rivalry played out in terms of two proxy wars right now in Syria and in Yemen. So I think we'd have to take it pretty seriously that if the Saudis say they would do this, for those who say they wouldn't, I'm not one of those who share a kind of calm about that. I think, in fact, they would do it.
Some would say that it's naive to suggest that the U.S. and Iran are somehow at odds in Syria when, in fact, they're working together to fight ISIS in Syria on some level, and that in fact the U.S. and Iran have more in common right now in terms of regional politics than they ever have had before, which is an argument for bringing normalized relations to the front burner here. What would you say to that?
Well, I guess I would say the following. I mean, I think we have a convergence of interests. You know, there's an old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, although I've often found the Middle East, the enemy of my enemy still ends up being your enemy. You know, when the Supreme Leader gives his Nowruz message and their chance death to America, it's clear there's an ideological basis to the regime that is founded on hostility towards us. There's a paradox because the Iranian public isn't hostile to us. We probably have, if you were to survey most of the countries of the Middle East and if there was an honest poll done, you'd probably find the Iranian public is probably the most pro-American of almost any in the region.
You might find the same poll of Americans regarding Iran, yet we hear from the Iranians' death to America, and we hear from American leaders, oh, the hostages, oh, the death right. of soldiers in Beirut. It's a mantra that won't stop. What's going to break it?
Well, I think as long as you have the Islamic Republic led by the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guard, whose ideology requires a hostility towards us to justify the kind of internal repression, you're going to find it difficult to change that. The question is whether an ideology that really isn't bought by the public, whether that changes Iran over time. A lot of times, I've sort of equated what we see in Iran to what we saw in the Soviet Union in 1980, where you had an ideology that the public didn't accept and much of the elite didn't accept. Those who were in power used it. Sooner or later, there's a corrosive reality where if no one really believes the ideology, it eats away at it and it's hard to sustain it. So my own view is, over time, we're likely to see this wear away. But between now and that point, a lot of destructive things can happen.
Ambassador Dennis Ross served as President Obama's special assistant on Iran from 2009 to 2011 and as President Clinton's chief U.S. negotiator for Arab-Israeli issues from 1993 to 2001. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.